With thousands of Bahamians looking for shelter and safety after Hurricane Dorian, what are the immigration rules if they try to come to the United States? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. A week ago, a cruise ship of Bahamian evacuees arrived in South Florida. Just a few days later, though, there was confusion about who would be allowed into the United States and for how long. Some who wanted to leave Freeport, Grand Bahama, were turned back. This week, the Department of Homeland Security released new guidelines for Bahamians seeking to come to the U.S. for a time. So what are they? And what's the effect on those looking to escape the devastation left by Dorian? One of the hardest-hit areas on Abaco Island, the Mud, was home to Haitians. What's next for them, and what's the response from the Haitian community here? Plus, the situation in Nassau as storm victims crowd into shelters. All ahead with your phone calls and texts on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Hurricane Dorian decimated the islands of Grand Bahama and Abaco. It began 12 days ago for the residents there. Thousands of Bahamians since now face a difficult decision in the days, weeks, and months ahead whether they should stay to rebuild, come to the United States for a while, or aim to start a new life away from the islands. Last weekend, more than 1,000 Bahamians boarded a cruise ship from Freeport to West Palm Beach. Bentley Williams was waiting in line at the harbor. He said he lost everything in the storm.
Just to get water alone to take a bath. That took me like maybe, 6 hours just to find water. I can't do it no more. I mean, I'll do anything just to get off the island. I don't want to be here no more.
That was a week ago. On Sunday, the immigration process became muddled. A ferry going from Freeport to Fort Lauderdale told some Bahamians on board to get off, even though they had the right documents to enter the United States. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is apparently requiring U.S. visas when previously a clean police record would suffice. Lots of questions around what are the immigration rules in the United States for Bahamians seeking shelter. Meantime, the death toll has climbed officially to at least 50. Officials estimate that 2,500 people are reported missing. According to some news reports, that number has dropped to 1,300 as of Thursday. So what are you hearing from relatives or friends? Were you able to make it here to South Florida from Grand Bahama or Abaco or Nassau if you stopped there? How are you contributing to the relief efforts for the Bahamas here 12 days after Hurricane Dorian began the devastation? 800-743-WLRN, our voice number here on the South Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. You could also send us a text. That text line, 786-786-7636. We got a text from Jesse in Miami saying that a friend of mine and I took a 37-foot private vessel filled with clothing, water, and food to Freeport. How are you helping out the relief efforts? Text us at 786-786-7636. Brian Inton is along with us now, investigative reporter for WSVN Channel 7 here in South Florida. He was on that ferry from Freeport to Fort Lauderdale. What was that moment like that you captured and heard on the loudspeaker, the confusion that was sowing regarding immigration status for the Bahamians seeking refuge?
Well, thanks for having me. It was really chaotic from the beginning. I just want to go back a little while when we first got to the ferry terminal at the harbor in Freeport. There was not much direction. People weren't really sure of what the rules were. They were lined up outside. There were no police. There were no workers for the ferry company or for the port. So it was a bit chaotic. People didn't know which doors to go in. They were locked out at one point. So it was difficult even getting into the terminal. Yeah. But they were told once inside that they needed their Bahamian passport and their police record, which is something they can print out, which is the way it's been in the past to get to the United States. So once we got on the ship, you know, people were getting on very, very slowly and obviously so relieved once they got on because this process of even getting on the ferry was so chaotic and sort of nerve-wracking for them. So you could sense that they were relieved once they got on and we were getting ready to leave. And that's when the announcement was made over the loudspeaker that there's been a change. If you do not have a U.S. visa, you have to get off right now.
What was that moment like for you?
You know, I was sort of, it took me a second to sort of click like, okay, this something's happening here. Something's changed. And people started looking at each other sort of like, this can't be true. Let's just take this in for a minute and see what's happening mm-hmm. here. And so a lot of people didn't get up from their seats. And that's when they came on again and said, you must have a U.S. visa. Things won't be good if you if you stay on the ship. You have to get off now. And so that's sort of when people started sort of gasping and just, you know, visibly became upset.
Yeah.
And there were people that started to get off, and there were still people that were staying in their seats. And then they came on again and said, we're going to be going around the entire ship, which was a big ship. It held, you know, hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And checking passports.
These were crew members doing this, not immigration
officials.
These
were crew members, okay. Right? It was all crew members for Beleria, which is the name of the ferry company. So then they started going around and checking passports. And at that point, you could tell people sort of just gave up. Like, you know, we're going to get off. We don't want any trouble. Most of them had kids, little babies crying. And it, you know, it was really sad to see that happen.
And Brian, there was lots of confusion about whose call it was. Was it the ferry company's call? Was there a call made by Customs Border Protection that this was the documentation necessary once they got to Fort Lauderdale? What's your assessment here in the cool light of several days later about where that decision lied?
So we still really don't know.
Yeah.
On the ship, the crew members were telling the passengers that we were told it was okay for you to come with a Bahamian passport and police record, but when we sent the manifest to Customs and Border Protection before we departed, they told us no, we've changed things and you need to get those people off the ship. But when we arrived into Port Everglades, you know, 6 hours later, because we had a stop in Bimini, you know, Customs and Border Protection was very quick to meet with us and tell us, no, that's not true. What was said on the ferry, they could have come. We never told them that they couldn't come, but we did sort of warn them that if they did come, it could be a very lengthy process and it could delay the ferry.
So that was Sunday into Monday. Tim Padgett is along with us covering the Caribbean and Latin America for us at WLRN. Then we heard from the administration, from the Trump administration, from the president himself. Do we have any kind of clarity at this point? A week after the first cruise ship came into West Palm Beach, a different ship than what Brian was on,
right,
about what the status is or could be expected by Bahamians who would like to leave Grand Bahama and Abaco.
It still seems very murky to me. I don't know if that's the consensus here at this table, but it still seems very murky to me. As of this time last week, we were expecting that it would just be protocol, really, for the Trump administration to grant the request from all of the top Florida politicians here to give Bahamians, at least those from Grand Bahama and Abaco Islands that were so hard hit by this hurricane, a visa waiver, meaning essentially to just make it very easy for them to get in, get off those islands, come here to stay with relatives, sort of regroup, get their lives back together. And it just seemed like a no-brainer. But by Sunday, Monday, we began to realize that it was going to be nothing of the sort. Things got further muddled. Mm-hmm. I think the word you used there was right on. And so, I mean, you know, Bahamians are showing us documents, for example, of all kinds of new things. It seems more complicated now than it was even before the hurricane. So it's just a little flabbergasting.
800-743-9576. If you've experienced this, have a family member, a neighbor, a coworker, a colleague, if you've heard about this, 800-743-9576. That's our voice line here on the South Florida Roundup. Text line 786-786-7636. Again, the text line 786-786-7636. Monique Madden covers immigration for our partner, the Miami Herald. She's with us via Skype. Monique, shed some any kind of light on here, because the Department of Homeland Security has talked about issuing new guidance this week. And as Tim points out, some of that guidance that we've heard and you've reported on include income statements, utility bills, notes or letters from employers. What's the status that you can kind of tease out of all this confusion?
Well, there's still a lot of confusion, and these people who have absolutely nothing. I spoke with people who only had the clothes they had on and perhaps maybe a purse or a backpack. They don't have these documents. They're being asked for letters from their employers. They're being told that they have to provide utility bills. One woman I spoke to said, how in the world am I going to have a copy of my utility bill when it was carried away in the roaring waters? people are upset. They feel that they've been targeted, that they're being ostracized, and that they're stranded. I spoke with another woman who's staying with pastors she met at the airport. She was rejected. She's been in the country four times this year. She clearly has the permission to be in the country. She's been through all the clearances and everything that she's had to go through immigration-wise. And then now after the hurricane, like some of my colleagues have said, it's become even more difficult to make it in. So they're confused, and a lot of them are still stranded.
Brian Inton with WSVN Channel 7. The president came out on Monday talking about his concerns about, quote, very bad people, end quote, from the Bahamas who could perhaps take advantage of the humanitarian emergency that's happening on those two islands, Grand Bahamas, Abacos, and some of the smaller islands around there. What did you experience when you were on that ferry as it came into Fort Lauderdale in terms of the Bahamians who were evacuating? How were they approaching this trip to the United States? Was this temporary? Was this something that they planned on staying for weeks, months, or open-ended?
Definitely temporary. Everyone we spoke to on the ferry, and I had a lot of time to walk around and talk to people during the ride over, everyone said that it was temporary. You know, they love the Bahamas. They love their island. They're Bahamians. They don't really have a desire to live in the United States. But in Freeport, where I was, you know, there's no power. There's no water. There's devastation everywhere. And they've been living like that since the hurricane. So, and a lot of them have family here. Mm-hmm. So it just made sense for them to take a break, come over, go to Publix, go grocery shopping, have some air conditioning for a week or so, and then head back. And that was really the plan. And I want to bring something else up because I think it's interesting. You talk about the change. On Saturday, the grand celebration from Freeport to Palm Beach.
That was the cruise ship, right? The first cruise ship
correct.
That had, I think, 1,000 yep. Bahamians on
right.
board,
before
who got
this,
on board in Freeport.
Yes, before this really became an issue, they arrived with over 1,000 Bahamians. Yep. Many of them did not have U.S. visas, and it was not a problem. Mm. And Customs and Border Protection was ready for it. So what changed from Saturday to now?
Paget?
My fear is that what changed was the optics. And this is a political perspective, unfortunately. But when I was talking to people in line in Freeport last Saturday to get on that ship, I was hearing some rumblings of confusion even then. And when I came back to Miami later that weekend, I began to have some fears myself that this is an administration that is very worried about appearing lenient in any way on immigration matters. And I really did begin to fear that we were going to see this muddling of the process, because this is an administration that, again, wants to give that optic that it's being tough all the time on immigration, particularly when there's a possibility, as you quoted the president, saying that there might be bad people mm-hmm. coming. And unfortunately, that's exactly what seems to have happened.
800-743-9576, the phone number, 800-743-WLRN, here on the South Florida Roundup. Monique Madden with the Miami Herald. To this point of the administration and the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection issuing statements, saying they're issuing guidelines, some of the statements and guidelines refer to agent discretion. What does that mean for a Bahamian who is seeking refuge in the United States, looking to evacuate for an indeterminate amount of time?
Sure. What that means is that whatever border agent they get next in line is the one that will determine, based on his or her own pure discretion, what their length of travel will be. I spoke with some CBP agents who said, well, I used to be in that post, and one thing I would look at is how many times this person has traveled to the U.S. in the last year. If I feel, and I'm talking as if I was the CBP, if that CBP officer feels that they've been here too long or too often in the last year, they'd give you a length of a shorter length of stay when the default time is usually about 6 months. So they're looking at that. And another thing, and this is important because it's been on these documents that they've been giving Bahamians, at least in Nassau, is that they want to see proof of a return flight. They want to make sure you're not going to stay in the United States. And that's something that's deeply troubling for a lot of people because sometimes they can't afford round trip tickets. And in other cases, people have had round trip tickets and they have not been cleared entry into the U.S. Hmm. So it's purely up to the CBP officer at that point.
You mentioned some of the guidance for the discretion. Is there a handbook anywhere that exists for the DHS for this discretion? Is there any guardrails on the discretion that these agents have?
There is, and it's detailed online, and some of the guidelines include health, communicable diseases, whether or not someone has a criminal history. It even mentions whether or not that person could be deemed a public charge in the U.S., which means perhaps a future burden, financial burden. They could also go off of your assets. They could look at your assets and say, well, this person doesn't plan to go back because, you know, it looks like that person may not have a lot back in the Bahamas. So there's a lot that they could look at in order to deem you, quote, inadmissible.
800-743-9576. That's the voice line again, 800-743-WLRN. The text line, 786-786-7636. 786-786-7636. This text came in from Michael in Miami. The issue is the Customs Border Protection always hold people on board of every vessel for clearance. There is nothing new. Michael continues in his text message, I have a family member on a Royal Caribbean ship. The question to ask is, why couldn't Customs Border Protection allow the Bahamians into a climate-controlled terminal at the port to await clearance? Brian, what did greet them for those that stayed on that ferry on Sunday once they got to Fort Lauderdale?
Yeah, they were able to get off and go through the normal immigration process. And it was interesting when we got back on the ferry, the port director for CBP was actually there waiting on us and took us to a conference room, the photographer I was with and I, and really spent a lot of time explaining this and sort of giving their side. And what they say is when a Bahamian does not have a U.S. visa, they have to do the vetting on the spot. And they have to make calls. They have to call the Bahamian authorities. And so their perspective was that that just takes so much time. And I asked him, what is the difference with the cruise ship that came and it went so smoothly and what's happening now? And he said that the cruise line called them in advance, days in advance, told them the plan, and they were able to get extra officers to Palm Beach and be ready for this sort of drawn out process. So he made it seem like it's very, very difficult to do that on the spot with large numbers of people.
There was also a comment here that Michael continued in his text to us saying, you can't blame the company for not wanting the vessel out of service for 12 hours, presumably for the vetting process. He says, our Customs and Border Protection process needs improvement. Americans are treated harshly abroad as a result of our poor CBP process and agent attitudes. Not sure there's a quid pro quo necessarily baked in there here, but how about that, Tim?
Well, I think this speaks to the point that we need better coordination in events like this. I think one of the practical things, and a lot of people who were in line for that celebration cruise line trip back to Palm Beach on Saturday, were mentioning that they wish that perhaps the Bahamian government and the U.S. government had coordinated better in terms of bringing U.S. officials to the front end of this whole problem, rather than waiting for them on the back end. It could have facilitated things a lot more smoothly, because even on that ship, it was chaos. You had thousands of people trying to get on that celebration ship on Saturday.
Understandably so.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And it was chaos. And a lot of them were wondering, well, you know, if this is the situation, if they know that we're all coming to Palm Beach, they wished that the Bahamian government and the U.S. government had coordinated to maybe facilitate more of this, as I said, on the front end rather than on the back end.
We focused a lot, and understandably so, on maritime here, immigration, because of the ports. Monique Madden covering immigration for the Miami Herald. Any sense of what it has been like for those that have been successful in getting to Nassau or another airport in the Bahamas and being able to fly into the United States?
Sure. I mean, like I said, they're getting to Nassau. The problem is getting into the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's really hit or miss. If you're from Abaco or if you're from Grand Bahama, which are the areas hardest hit, you're going to be screened a little extra, or may I say a lot extra. They are asking for your boss's number. I mean, your parents' number, the address of where you will be staying. They're telling people you cannot enroll your children in schools. It's just absolutely crazy. People are missing their flights. And once they're here, they're scared because they're being given shorter amounts of time. I've reported that they're being given about 2 weeks in the U.S. And they're saying that that's not enough time. Where are they going to go back to? How are they going to regroup their lives? They're petrified, to be honest.
The text line to join the conversation, 786-786-7636. Text us your concerns, your questions, maybe your experiences with Customs Border Patrol, 786-786-7636 or 800-743-9576. That's the voice line, 800-743-9576. That's the phone number that Kathleen in Key Biscayne called. Kathleen, you're on the radio. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling because this issue is absolutely disgusting. I know they're white Bahamians, but the majority are black. Why aren't they allowed into this country for the time that their island has been devastated? This is similar to Puerto Rico, only Puerto Rico is a little bit farther away. I think it's absolutely disgusting, discriminating. I can't stand the idea that Trump has all to say is becoming like a communist country. That's how I feel.
Kathleen, I appreciate you sharing that. Of course, the big difference with Puerto Rico is you don't need a visa. You don't need a passport. Those are Puerto Ricans are, of course, citizens of the United States and can travel freely here. Brian, did you sense any racial component to this on that ferry?
I didn't on the ferry. I mean, there were people bringing up President Trump when this happened, sort of like the caller thinking that, oh, gosh, you know, that may have something to do with it. I didn't sense that in the ferry, and when I met with Customs and Border Protection, I certainly didn't sense that. I got the sense from at least the port director genuinely that he wanted to be able to let the Bahamians in, even who didn't have a visa, but that it was much more complicated than I understood and that, you know, people understood.
Yeah. Monique, how about for you? Do you see a racial component in this, like Kathleen in Key Biscayne?
Well, I can't speak to that, but I've spoken to people who have said that they do.
Yeah.
I've spoken to maybe three individuals who have mentioned that they think it's based on race, but they didn't have anything concrete to say. That was just very an emotional thing that they were going off of, and they thought that if this was a European country, then it wouldn't be happening.
Yeah, I agree. With that, and in the sense that I don't think it was overtly racial. I think it comes down more to this hardline immigration optic. For example, why was the Miami Urban Search and Rescue Team, which is one of the finest in the world, on any disaster like this in past administrations, Republican or Democrat, it was only just a matter of days, if not hours, before a U.S. president signed off on that team going to the disaster site? President Trump never did that.
Right.
And a lot of people are asking why. And I go back to, as you mentioned, Puerto Rico. There's this feeling that, no, we don't want to do, you know, we want to show at least our voter base, you know, that we're putting up those walls, that we're being tough. When, you know, that we're not just being so lenient and haphazard with this sort of stuff as past administrations are. We're different. And I think a lot of the lax response that we saw on the part of the U.S. and Puerto Rico, I saw in some ways duplicated in the Bahamas with things like the Urban Search and Rescue Team.
Yeah. And we also heard early on some calls from the congressional delegation in Florida regarding some immigration waivers, for instance, for Bahamians, visa waivers. Monique, where did those calls land with the administration?
They have not been granted. They're still pending, and the senator's office and members of Congress are still waiting anxiously to see if that's going to happen. But people are losing hope. I've spoken to several congressional offices, and they say that they don't think it's going to happen.
Monique Madden covering immigration with us from our partner, the Miami Herald. She's with us via Skype. Brian Inton with WSVN Channel 7, who was on the ferry from Freeport to ultimately to Fort Lauderdale, which kind of began this real muddled look at immigration between the Bahamas and the United States. Tim Padgett covering the Caribbean and Latin America with us here at WLR. And all three of you, thanks for joining us on the Rondo. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Yeah, lots more to come here. Stick with us. Dorian destroyed a home to many Haitians in the Bahamas. We're going to continue talking about the aftermath of the storm. What's next for those Haitians in the Bahamas? That's coming up next on the South Florida Rondo. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It was 12 days ago when Hurricane Dorian stalled over Abaco Island in the Bahamas, bearing down 185-mile-an-hour winds, gusts up to 220 miles per hour. It sat there for more than a day. Stationary was the official forecast for many hours from the National Hurricane Center. One of the hardest-hit areas was the Mud, home to many Haitians in the Bahamas. The Haitian-American community here in South Florida is concerned, certainly, about the future of Haitians in the Bahamas. They're the country's largest migrant group and have faced enormous prejudice. We're taking your phone calls and texts here on the South Florida Roundup, talking about the aftermath of Dorian in many different ways. A part of the Haitian-American community here in South Florida, your reaction to what's needed by the Haitian community in the Bahamas. Have you gotten word from friends or family members from Abaco Island, from the Mud? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. That is our voice line. Maybe you've staged a relief drive and you would like to have some more information about what's happening in the Bahamas, Grand Bahama and Abaco particularly. Send us a text at 786-786-7636. The text line again, 786-786-7636. The Miami Herald's Caribbean correspondent, Jacqueline Charles, is along with us from our studios inside the Miami Herald in Doral. Jackie, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
What are you hearing out of the Mud here 12 days later?
Well, let me just say this. I just recently came back from Abaco a few days ago, and I actually went to Treasure Key. So there are three Haitian settlements on Abaco. You have the Mud, and you also have Pigeon Peas, which is near the Mud, and you also have Sandbanks, which is further away in Treasure Key. And basically in Sandbanks, everything was destroyed like the Mud. The Haitians that I spoke to there, they said that they didn't lose anyone because everyone actually evacuated and went to a church that was nearby. And at one point when the water started rising, people were even climbing the ropes to get into the rafters. In the Mud itself, there's still a lot of questions in terms of how many Haitians may have lost their lives. I mean, the Bahamian government is asking for patience. They're saying counting the dead is not a priority. But at the same time, their numbers hold at 50. Yet the list of missing persons is at 1,300. How many Haitians are on that list? We don't know. How many Haitians actually registered missing individuals on that list? We still do not know. So there's a lot of unknown in regard to the Haitian community there. But I can tell you just from my visits both to Abaco Treasure Key and Eleuthera, where people were being brought in, there's a lot of uncertainty. We also had a team in Abaco and in the Mud itself. Mm-hmm. They're still sifting through that wreckage, trying to find bodies. Everywhere you go, you do smell the stench of death, whether, you know, is it a body, is it an animal, that's still unclear.
For the Haitians who sought refuge in that church in Treasure Key, where are they now?
So, interesting enough, there are about 200 who sought refuge in that church, and it's down now to about 50. Some have left to go to Nassau, but a lot of them are also staying behind in Abaco, in Marsh Harbor, and also in Treasure Key. They're afraid. The Bahamian government has been very compassionate, despite the history of the Bahamas in regards to Haitians and the discrimination. They have said that as of this moment, there will be no deportations of Haitians or any undocumented migrants that were were part of this disaster in Abaco and Grand Bahama. Everybody is being treated fairly. I've witnessed this myself. Mm-hmm. I did not see any Haitians turned away, not given aid because they were Haitian or because they didn't speak the language. At some point, I even had to help translate when I was in Eleuthera. But the Haitians are still scared. They know what the history is. And when I was talking to people in Treasure Key, they said, you know what, even if we go to Nassau in a couple of months, they can say you've worn out your welcome and we're going to deport you to Haiti. But the idea that you have to write your name and register and have your picture taken and you have to turn over your date of birth, that they will now have a record on where to track me. So as a result, you have people who have decided to just toughen it out in Abaco.
We've heard similar, you know, concerns here in the United States, right? When they were opening up shelters, for instance, in Palm Beach County, as Dorian was threatening Palm Beach County, the sheriff came out and said, we're not checking immigration status at these shelters. We're encouraging people who are in evacuation zones to please seek shelter, and we are not going to be checking immigration status. Is the Bahamian government providing any kind of assurances along those lines?
No, but they've said it. But if when you're going through the process and people who have gone through the process, I mean, when you are going through an intake, they will ask you, do you have any identification? And the person says, no, I don't have any identification, because a lot of people have lost their IDs in the storm. They said, okay, they take their name down, they take the other information, but it's part of this built-in mistrust, mm-hmm. you know, that is there. The Prime Minister, Minnis, days after the storm, he physically visited Abaco. He met with the Haitian communities, many of them who had lived in the mud, and he promised them that, you know, their children will be able to get into school in Nassau. And there were people who left, and there are people who, you know, who have not left. I mean, what's happening in the Haitian community is because they don't have any connections with the Haitians in the Bahamas. You know, the Bahamas, the Haitian-Bahamian problem did not just start with Hurricane Dorian.
Explain that a little bit further. Help me understand that.
Well, you know, Haitians in the Bahamas have long been discriminated against, despite the fact that there is a rich history in terms of Haitians in the Bahamas and Haitians helping to build the Bahamas. But as a result of that, though, what you have the Haitian American community here, they don't know who the Haitian leaders are on the ground. They didn't have anybody to call. Last week, you know, I got so many phone calls from people. What should we be doing about the Haitians in the Bahamas? I mean, there was this anticipation that there was going to be problems. There was going to be discrimination. There were these videos that were going around, one of which accuses a prominent Bahamian pastor of accusing Haitians of starting the hurricane because of their practice of voodoo. I called this pastor. He was just completely shocked, dismayed, I mean, and just really hurt that something would be quote unquote fabricated like this about him. And, you know, and so you have a lot of this that's just going around. Yes, there are other videos where you have people who are Bahamians who are saying, you know, with those Haitians, you know, we need to get rid of them. We need to do this. We need to do that. But I can tell you from my reporting and from the outstretch of support, what I have seen is a very compassionate Bahamas in respect to the victims of this storm. Yes, mm-hmm. there are problems with aid. Yes, there are problems with coordination. I myself, coming off the plane from Treasure Key, I was there with Bahamians who didn't have the proper paperwork or had a police ID, and the issue you guys were talking about, mm-hmm. I saw it firsthand. But overall, in terms of how Haitians are being treated, no, there's been no threat of discrimination. There's now, can it change in a couple of months? Sure. Should the Haitian government and a representative on the ground stay on top of this and follow this? Indeed. Because the fear is real for them. Yeah. It's with the history.
How would you describe the relations between governments, between the Bahamas and Haiti, if that's a key place to look for kind of the future of Haitians that are on the islands in the Bahamas?
Look, the issue is, like, right before this storm, there were some issues in the Haitian embassy in the Bahamas because of the problem with undocumented Haitians coming into the Bahamas, the boats. It's been a very strained relationship. Haiti itself is riddled with problems. I tweeted a tweet where the Prime Minister of the Bahamas said that he had received a phone call from Haitian President Jovenel Moise expressing condolences and offering any sort of assistance. I mean, people on Twitter just went crazy. They were snickering. What kind of assistance? A lot of smart, you know, but they forgot that you have a sizable Haitian population that's there. And when I got to Treasure Key and I went with Dr. Rudy Moise, who's a South Florida physician, Haitian American, and the people told us that we were the first Haitians that they have met since the storm happened. The chargé d'affaires for the Haitian embassy, he It took him 5 days to get into Abaco, and he only made it as far as Marsh Harbor. But there were thousands of Haitians in Treasure Key, some of whom did not even speak any English. You know, they were alone. They were scared. Mm-hmm. They don't have any representative. They don't know what's going on. And while I was there just a few days ago, what I found is a lot of them are operating on fear and on rumor. You know, this fear that they will be deported either today, tomorrow. You know, I go to Nassau, I'm going to be exposed. I'm going to get sent back to Haiti.
For those that have left this area in the Abaco, these three neighborhoods that you speak about, what are they encountering? What kind of resources have been made available to them if they've stayed in the Bahamas?
They are, a lot of them are in shelters. I mean, one of the Haitian church in Nassau is one of the shelters that the government is using. But one of the issues is that in order for you to be able to access some of the aid that's coming in, you have to register. For instance, the Bahamian government said today, I believe that there are 10,000 children who are victims of this storm, and they're trying to enroll them in schools in Nassau. But you have to register. So again, that fear in preventing you from doing it because you have this mistrust.
Yeah.
And so that's a challenge. And just average Bahamian, for instance, in Grand Bahama, in order for you to get aid, you have to go to a distribution center. Nobody's coming to your door and knocking mm-hmm. there, but you have to have a car. So imagine for people whose cars were flooded and not working, and then they've got holes in their ceilings. So this has been a criticism just from average Bahamians who are victims of Dorian.
And you mentioned that you spoke and saw many who were staying in Abaco. The conditions there have just got to be horrific, and any sense of improvement of any kind of international relief effort that is getting to where it's needed most in these areas.
There's a lot of aid that's coming in, but even today, Carl Smith...
Is it organized?
It's organized, but again, here's the problem. Logistically, you know, where I went in Sandbanks, for instance, I mean, there was only one wooden structure that was standing. Yeah. Everything else was just a mountain of debris. And I found, you know, these two men who were basically building a shack because they knew that the weather was going to be changing today and over the weekend.
Yeah.
So they were trying to build a shack to salvage, to save whatever they had managed to salvage. But people, there's no electricity. There's no running water. People are taking buckets, you know, bath buckets. Fuel is also being rationed, and you don't know when the fuel boat is going to come. People really they need sleeping material because they're sleeping outside in the elements. Some people told me that they wanted to go to the church, but because the church is overcrowded and these churches, they want their buildings back.
Mm-hmm.
So there really wasn't a lot of options for them. I mean, Haitians have asked, what can they do? I mean, people are sending aid. I think that window in terms of aid and the Colgates and the food, yes, it's needed, but a lot of it is coming through. I think for the Haitian community that these people need so much more, because the biggest thing is the housing. They cannot go back and live in these pieces of zinc sheeting that they call a house
mm-hmm.
or pieces of plywood that are not going to withstand the element or another, God forbid, another hurricane.
Well, not a hurricane, but certainly very bad weather is likely to happen this weekend, if not here on this Friday, as you and I are talking, Jackie. I mean, what kind of preparation, if any, what kind of evacuation could possibly be offered?
I mean, there are shelters that are set up, but again, you have to be able to have the transportation or be willing to walk to get there. Some people's tarps have been distributed, but again, some people may have to go and get their tarps. I mean, it's the biggest issue. It's not the lack of aid that's coming in, but it's the ability of individuals who have been impacted by Dorian to get to the aid.
Yeah, and that's just the physical well-being, the emotional well-being of this population, having endured a day and a half of a Category 5 storm just 12 days ago to face the possibility of wind gusts at 40 miles an hour has got to be just traumatizing.
Let me tell you, even if this storm was not coming there, it's traumatizing. I have a cousin who is a priest in Grand Bahama, and he told me that since Dorian left, he has spent every day just counseling people, not just his congregation members, but other people in Grand Bahama. I mean, people are traumatized. They've never experienced anything like this. They have PTSD, and they're just looking at what's in front of them, and they just cannot figure out how to put their lives back together. Where do you even begin? And as of today, we still don't know what the price tag is on this storm. And a lot of people certainly the Haitians, they don't have any insurance. I mean, I talked to one guy in Treasure Key. He said to me the only thing that he managed to save was his passport. And this is a guy who makes 80 Bahamian, which is practically 80 U.S. Mm-hmm. dollars a day, you know, doing carpentry.
Meantime, the United Nations this week did acknowledge that some initial estimates that it gave out for the number of homeless in the Bahamas, 70,000, was not correct, was flawed. You've covered disasters like this before. What do you make of this, politely, miscommunication?
Well, it's difficult because we don't even really have a census. I mean, I've asked different people on what the population is on Abaco, and mm-hmm. I've gotten three different numbers. And when you look, the last census was taken like in 2010. I mean, we've always said the Bahamas, the population is probably 300,000, but people move around and there really isn't a sense of the numbers. Today, we asked NEMA how many people remain on Abaco and how many people have left for the U.S.
That's
or
the
left
emergency
the country.
Agency for the Bahamas.
Exactly.
NEMA.
Yeah. And they can't give us a number. What they've told us is 4,500 people have come into Nassau that they know of that's registered, but they acknowledge that a lot of people may have come and did not register. So it's really hard to get that sense in terms of the numbers of people that are impacted. What we do know is Grand Bahama and the Abacos, which include 15 keys that have been heavily impacted. They are the second and third most populous islands in the Bahamas.
Jackie, thank you for sharing your reporting with us and for all of South Florida, for that matter. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Jackie Charles, the Caribbean correspondent for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios inside the Herald in Doral. We got lots more to come here on the South Florida Roundup, continuing our focus and conversation around the aftermath of Dorian, how first responders are navigating the rubble to distribute supplies in the Bahamas, and the situation in Nassau. It's all ahead as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public media. The aftermath of Hurricane Dorian, 12 days after it first came ashore in the northern Bahamas, continues to take a toll on the Bahamas, just offshore from South Florida. The storm, of course, left roads, airports, harbors, communication channels all in disarray. We're joined by NPR's Jason Bovian. He was in Abaco and Nassau this week reporting on the infrastructure challenges. 800-743-WLRN, your questions, your observations. Maybe you've been on a relief run on a private vessel, on a boat with your neighbor. 800-743-9576 to share that experience with us, or on text line at 786-786-7636. Again, the text line 786-786-7636. Jason is with us via Skype. Welcome to WLRN, Jason. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience in Nassau first, as we were seeing hundreds, if not thousands, of evacuees come in.
Yeah, I mean, people were just flooding into Nassau, and it's going to be one of the big challenges. You've got people pulling out of Grand Bahama, Abaco. You know, it doesn't seem like people are going to be able to go to school there anytime soon. Those people are coming into Nassau. The Bahamas is facing a huge challenge in the wake of Hurricane Dorian. And, you know, even just this week, they're still just trying to sort that out, trying to sort out getting relief supplies to people, trying to sort out, where people are going to go to school. One of the shelters was over 1,200 people at it. This is a big one.
Describe that shelter for us. What did you experience there? What did you see? And what was the experience for the evacuees?
So I ended up going to a Salvation Army shelter, which was actually one of the smaller ones. They were keeping the media away from this sports complex, which sounds like is incredibly overcrowded from all we were hearing. But this Salvation Army one, which was one of the smaller ones, people were just sleeping on, you know, thin kind of like yoga mats on the floor. They had food, they had bathrooms, but the really crazy thing is, like, everybody there, it's just unclear where they go next. People are still in a state of shock from this storm, which was incredibly terrifying. Yeah. Then their houses were destroyed. And that was sort of the big thing that I came away with. People just don't know where they're going next and how they're going to move forward.
And what about communications, even amongst those evacuees in the shelter? I mean, are they getting information that can help them make some decisions?
You know, on this one, there's been so many rumors flying around. It has been just crazy. I mean, I don't think I've seen a rumor mill start and move so fast as in this disaster. You know, things about, you know, gangs of men with machetes marauding through the streets. And then you go into Marsh Harbor, where supposedly this is happening, and it's like quiet and peaceful. And the only people you meet are like people who are desperate. You go into the supermarket where supposedly people are looting and people are kind of taking like one thing off the shelf and not and apologizing about it.
Yeah.
You know, it was so the communication has been a big issue. You know, the government was downplaying the number of deaths, mm-hmm. which, you know, they were saying they expected it to go up. But I think that really struck people who had seen many people dead in the streets in Marsh Harbor already. They felt like it wasn't truthful. And so they felt like there was more distrust towards the government. So communications has been an issue on this one. Yeah.
Information has been a big casualty here. And that's not to minimize at all the human tragedy, of course, that is continuing to take shape as we're trying to get that kind of information. How about the relief efforts? Those are concentrated in Nassau, we know. The port there, the airport, obviously, Nassau was left unharmed with its infrastructure there. But did you see kind of a coordinated effort for distribution of these supplies?
Yes, I did. I think that they have done a very good job of, you know, it took a few days to get things up and running. At first, you couldn't even get helicopters or anything into Abaco and Grand Bahama because at first the airports were completely underwater. Once that eased up, they're first flying with helicopters, then flying with small planes. Then as that water receded away from the airstrips, they were able to get in bigger planes. It is quite an impressive operation. And when I flew out of Abaco, I actually came out on a flight from Bahamas Air, where they were evacuating people out, and they had extra seats. And so they said, yeah, come along. And you land, and there was like the people were standing there handing you cold water as you walked off. Mm-hmm. And then there was like, they were offering sandwiches and cookies. And then they had a setup where they were checking who you are, registering you, trying to make sure that people who are missing get acknowledged, trying to find out what you need. There was a very good system set up there at one of the terminals there at the airport to allow people to get access into the system at least and get directed to shelters if they need that, or allowed to make phone calls to friends if they needed to do that.
We're speaking with NPR correspondent Jason Beaubien, who spent time in Nassau and Abaco Island this week. Jason, you have the unique vantage point as well as covering global health. And I'm wondering, as you were in Abaco after this devastation left over by Dorian, what are the public health concerns that need to be front and center for search and rescue and relief efforts and for government and international agencies as they look at this enormous rebuilding challenge ahead?
So, at the moment, the official missing is at 1,300, mm-hmm. right? That's what the government is saying. It's probably going to come down from there, but we're talking, you know, I think this is going to be a death toll in the hundreds, and those bodies are still out there, and they're in the wreckage, and that needs to get cleaned up because in the hot tropical sun, this, you know, it's just, they're just going to be rotting there, and that needs to get dealt with. So that's like an immediate thing. The other big issue is water. You had, it's hard to estimate, 10 feet of water coming all the way into Marsh Harbor. Other parts of Abaco Island, also the island was, you know, the water from the sea came all the way in, got into wells.
Got into freshwater wells were contaminated with seawater. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you've got people who, you know, would be running generators to try to, or they would normally be using electricity to pump water out of those wells. So the issue of water is a huge one. And whether that water is contaminated, whether the groundwater is going to be drinkable, they have done a good job of getting bottled water in. So there's like, you know, at the port there in Marsh Harbor, you could just go and pick up a crate of water. Supplies like that were coming in, and food as well. There was food coming in. Nobody looked to me like they were starving or not going to have enough to drink. But the question is, long term, how affected were those water supplies? how soon can you get them back up and running? And if you have to be just sort of having people survive off of bottled water, you know, is there a sustainable delivery mechanism, and how long can that keep going? So I think that water is going to be a really big issue in the longer term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly everything that comes along with that. Did you see the beginning of debris clearing at all? I mean, we've seen some video and pictures and experiences that, you know, ports and some the docks that did withstand the storm were open again, and some of the roads had been cleared a little bit.
So, yeah, debris clearing in terms of bulldozing things out of the road so that people can get past, bulldozing stuff away from the dock so that you can access it, you know, clearing the airport, you know, getting planes that were blown out onto the tarmac and getting things out so that you can use that. The task of clearing this massive amount of particularly Marsh Harbor, which is I did not get the Grand Bahama, so I was in Abaco. The devastation just goes on and
wholesale
on and on. And
obliteration. Yeah.
And so it's just going to have to be bulldozed. I mean, there are areas that are most of Marsh Harbor is going to need to get bulldozed. And that task hasn't even started.
Jason, thank you for sharing your reporting with us here at WLRN. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
Jason Beaubien is global health correspondent and development correspondent with NPR with us via Skype here on the South Florida Roundup. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Furtado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Meritz. Director of radio programming at WLRN is Jason Zabka. The show's technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, texting, listening, and supporting WLRN. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
Hurricanes, lightning, flooding, and tornadoes affect the entire state of Florida, and the team of meteorologists from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network keep you informed around the clock. All year long, we are committed to providing in-depth weather coverage, both over the radio and on the mobile app Florida Storms. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by this station and Citizens Property Insurance, online at citizensfla.com.
The Florida International Trade and Cultural Expo is back October 9th and 10th at the Broward County Convention Center. You can attend the FITSE World Expo Marketplace and meet buyers and sellers from over 60 countries. Free registration at FITCExpo.com.
South Florida has one of the largest college student populations in the country. The rising cost of a degree has become a central issue in the 2020 election. Monday morning at 9 on the Sunshine Economy, hear from three leaders of three different schools on the cost of higher education.
If you're a full-time student, about $2,400 a year.
Roughly $3,400 a semester.
All in, it's about $50,000.
I'm Tom Hudson. The program is made possible by Kaufman Rawson.
This is 91.3 WLRN in HD1, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM in HD1, Marathon, Key West, 90.7 WFLV HD4, West Palm Beach, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches. Science Friday's next. It's